Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where my guest reveals the five things from their life that they would like to preserve in a time capsule. They can pick four things that they cherish, but they must also tell me the one thing they regret and would like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in this episode is the comedian and actor Les Dennis, who started his career performing in the social clubs of his hometown, Liverpool, until winning the talent show New Faces in 1974, which launched him onto our TV screens in shows with Russ Abbott and then with his comedy partner, Dustin Gee, in The Laughter Show. Following Dustin's sudden death in 1986, Les continued as a solo performer and became the third host of the quiz show Family Fortunes, which he hosted for 15 years. His obvious comic skills remain strong, as his appearance in Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's TV series Extras demonstrated. In 2014, he joined the cast of Coronation Street, playing Michael Rodwell, a petty burglar. I hate it when people are petty, don't you? Throughout all this, Les built quite a catalogue of stage work, playing the lead in Me and My Girl and Amos Hart in Chicago in the West End, as well as roles in Skylight, Mr. Wonderful, Misery, High School Musical 2, Hairspray, The Addams Family, Spamalot, and Legally Blonde the Musical. In 2019, he fulfilled a lifelong ambition when he performed in The Provoked Wife and Venice Preserved in Stratford for the Royal Shakespeare Company. So let's hear the boy from Speak in Liverpool speak and find out what he treasures and the one thing he wants to be rid of.
So Les, we've only met a few times in our life, haven't we?
We have only met a few times, yeah. But instantly, I think we've kind of just got on.
Yeah.
That's what our business is, isn't it? You know, you straight away, on a first day of rehearsal, you know immediately with the people you're going to get on with and connect.
Mm.
And then when you meet them years later, you just pick up where you were before.
Absolutely.
It's a kind of nomadic existence, isn't it? So, you know, we all know that we're all disparate people going all over the place and that one day we will probably meet again and maybe work again, be fortunate enough to work again together.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed for that.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're going to talk about some things you want to put into a time capsule.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
This was really difficult.
Was it?
Yeah, because you want to put so many things in. So to kind of narrow it down to four that you love and one that you maybe don't love so much is tough, but I've got a list for you, I think.
Great. All right, well, let's work our way through it and see what happens.
Okay.
All right, what's your first thing?
The first thing that I'm going to put into the time capsule is an EP. And for people that may be too young to know what an EP is, it was somewhere between a single and an LP.
What's a single and what's an LP?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. It's vinyl. It's a vinyl record called Sammy Davis Jr. Impersonates. And my mum and dad were big Rat Pack fans. On our radiogram, we had all the Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Tony Bennett. All those were the kind of things that my mum used to play on the radiogram. And one night when I was about 12, my mum and dad went to see Sammy Davis Jr. live do his one-man show at the Empire Theatre in Liverpool. And they came back with the program, and my mum, who was a great storyteller and was so vivid in, you know, she would, if she'd been to see the film Shane, she'd come home and tell me the whole plot and tell me exactly, absolutely word for word and describe it brilliantly. Or if she'd read Dracula, she would tell me and vividly when we were standing in the kitchen when I was a kid, I used to be her commis chef on a Sunday when my dad went out for his 2 pints before our Sunday dinner. You know, so she would tell me these stories of things that she'd love to see. And she just never stopped talking about this night with Sammy Davis Jr. and how he'd had guns in holsters and he'd done this whole kind of gunslinger routine and his tap dancing and his amazing crooning and just a great showman. And also his impressions. She kept going on about his impressions. And she brought this EP that I put on. And I was playing it every day. It was him doing singing impressions. People like Mel Torme, Mario Lanza.
Wow.
He did a version of Sonny Boy, Climb Upon My Knee, Sonny Boy, doing Jimmy Cagney and Jimmy Stewart and all these great film stars. And that was kind of like, I thought, wow, I'm obsessed with this. The idea that this guy becomes these other people so well. So that's how I started my act. I kind of collated his stuff along with maybe impressions of Freddie Parrotface Davis, and who was around at the time, and Steptoe and Son at that time. I put together a little act and went round charity shows. My mum took me because she had always wanted to entertain. When she was a kid, she had a chance of being on Carol Levis Discoveries. He was the kind of, which was Britain's Got Talent of its day. She had been standing outside the Empire Theatre when she was, I think, 14. And Carol Levis was a big show on radio at that time. And the start of the show used to go, paging Carol Levis, paging Carol Levis. And my mum stood at the stage door and shouted, paging Carol Levis, paging Carol Levis. And Carol Levis walked out to the stage door and said to my mum, if you've got the talent to match your cheek, then I will give you an audition tomorrow. Come back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And my mum ran all the way home. They lived in Garston, which was, you know, on the outskirts of Liverpool, on the docks. She ran all the way home excited to tell her mum that she had this audition. And her mum said, no, sorry, you start work in the Bobbins Works tomorrow. And she started work in a factory at 14, you know. So she didn't get her chance. So she saw in me that I wanted to do this. So I started with this Sammy Davis Jr. impersonations and did the talent competition when we went to Butlins. We used to go to Pwllheli in North Wales for 1 week a year. And 1 year when I was 14, we decided to go to Filey because Pwllheli seemed to be too competitive. Everybody, you know, the talent competition at Butlins was, when it got to the adult talent competition, it was quite massive. It was the People National Talent Competition. And the prize was to get to the Palladium, and then it was £1,000. That was a lot of money. It'd be about 1968.
You made a good choice of going to Butlins then, because we used to go to Pontins.
Oh, did you? Okay.
And the prize for that was they had the grand final at the end of the season, so you got another week's holiday.
Exactly. That was the thrilling thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because I went on in Filey, and I was 14, and I was just eligible for the adult talent competition, and I won the weekly heat. I beat all these people who were in their 20s and 30s, all these bands and great singers doing Sammy Davis Jr., doing Jerry Lewis, singing Lulu's Back in Town. Gotta get my old tuxedo pressed. Gotta sew a button on my vest. And, you know, and Jimmy Stewart, oh, well, when you're old and gray, dear, would you promise that you'll you'll never stride, because I mean, I got to have somebody, and I got you, sonny boy. And I just listened and listened, and I won the heat and went back for the free week, which was amazing. At the end of the holiday, my mum had to come with me then. But as I got older, I used to go on my own for that, because I used to then every year, that was my goal, to go into the talent competition. And one year I was in it with a double act called the Harper Brothers, who went on to be Cannon and Ball. and we both lost. So, so that was my beginning. And I think it conjures up for me that if I listen to that Sammy Davis EP, I haven't got a copy anymore, but I've noticed it's on eBay and I'm going to order it as soon as I've finished with you and listen again, because it conjures up for me all the wonderful things that my mum did for me to get me into the business. She was my inspiration, really. She was a showbiz mother, but she wasn't like a pushy showbiz mother. She nurtured and saw that I wanted to do it, and she encouraged me right through. And she died in 1977. She didn't see any of the stuff, really, but she kind of, in her heart, she knew I was going to be okay. She kind of really knew it. And she wasn't a snob. We were working class, but she wanted us to do better. And she got us out of a prefab in Speke, and she got us into a council house in Childwall, which was quite posh for us. And she got herself a little money box, and she called it Mum's Car Box. And we all laughed because she was saving up for a car. But she saved pennies and sixpences and eventually got a car. And that car was the car that drove me around the working men's clubs and helped me start in this business. So that beginning, you know, that nurturing by my mum, and that finding that little thing, that EP, was something that set me on a road.
What a great inspiration as well, though. When parents do that, it's not like the pushy mum actually sort of living vicariously through you. It's very much sort of seeing the enthusiasm that she had and wanting you to have something she didn't have, that she missed out on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Sammy Davis Jr. is just the most extraordinary person to be inspired by. I remember seeing him do it on Sunday night at the London Palladium.
Yes.
As well.
I worked with Lionel Blair. We did a play, Don't Dress for Dinner, and I became real friends with lovely Lionel Blair. And if you look, if you Google and find Lionel Blair and Sammy Davis Jr., live on Sunday night at the London Palladium, doing this amazing tap routine in a men's outfitters, you know, with bowler hats and umbrellas. And he comes to buy an umbrella, I think, Sammy Davis Jr., from Lionel in this sketch. And it's about 7 or 8 minutes.
Wow.
And it's live. And it's incredible. You know, people always said, oh, well, Lionel, you know, he dances a bit. He danced a lot. You watch him with Sammy Davis Jr., he's incredible. And that, you know, I've been fortunate enough in my career to work with some great pros, you know, people who've taught me. I did a summer season with Jimmy Tarbuck. That was my first summer season. And he taught me so brilliantly stagecraft, how to walk onto a stage, how to make the best of your 7 minutes you've got, you know, or whatever. Maybe in a summer season, it was more like 12 I would have. But he was wonderful and very nurturing again.
Lovely. Well, I do remember when I was a little boy, I used to sing with my dad in old-time musicals. And occasionally we would do shows that weren't old-time musicals and we were able to sing other songs. And it's the only impression I've ever done in my life. And it was me, amazingly. This is an extraordinary crossover.
Yeah.
It was me impersonating Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, wow.
Impersonating Nat King Cole.
Oh. That's... He did it so great. God, come on, please. You've got to give us a bit of your
nap. It's going to be terrible now. It's going to be really terrible now.
No, it's not.
Okay. I used to sing, hang on. Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by.
That's amazing. That's so good.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. I know exactly. You will have listened. I did the same with his Louis Armstrong. I used to do it in my act. And then I went to the doctors and I said, I'm getting a sore throat a lot. And he said, well, tell me what are you doing? I said, well, I do this impression. He said, stop doing it. That was his advice. That Nat King Cole, you have listened to the intonation. And these guys were all about intonation, weren't they? You know, the selling of a song was as important as the tunefulness of it. You know, Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, probably the greatest interpreter of those great American songbook classics. You know, he was amazing.
Yeah, beautiful. What a lovely thing to put in.
That is a crossover.
I've never done that impression apart from in an old people's home.
Fantastic. I love it.
Thank you very much, because I'd forgotten that I could do it.
Well, you still can. It's still there. It's like riding a bike.
I'm not sure I can do that anymore. Okay, Len, so we're going to put Sammy Davis Jr. impressions into the time capsule. I put it on a nice little portable...
Dansette.
That's the one.
My sister had the Dansette, and that's what the one that I could take away from the radiogram and play on my own, yeah.
Fabulous. Okay, that's your first item. So what's number two?
Number two is a trip. It's a school trip that we made in 1970. So I would be 16, 17. And it was a school trip with the English department. We went to Stratford-on-Avon, for about 3 nights. And we saw plays at the Memorial Theatre, the RSC.
Yeah.
And one play that I saw, it was Twelfth Night. And I think that Judi Dench was in it. But there was one actor that stood out for me. His name was Emrys James. He was amazing. He played Feste. And I just watched and believed in this powerful clown, this beautiful performance by this man who was funny, was engaging. And, you know, I think we were reading Twelfth Night and I hadn't really got it. And then seeing that production and sitting there and going, do you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to do that. I want to be on that stage doing this. And I'd already started doing the working men's clubs, as we talked about. So I'd already started going down a particular route. But I remember then coming out and thinking, I so want to go that way. And I was in a group of people at school, Clive Barker, the horror writer, and Jude Kelly, who went on to run the South Bank and the West Yorkshire Playhouse. So I was in a great group of people, and we did school plays, and I loved them. But I think that was the one time when I thought, I want to do this professionally. Oh, hang on a minute. I'm already doing the clubs, because I was doing the clubs while I was at school. Mm. So I went down the comedy route, but somehow in the back of my head, it was like, well, I want to one day be able to act. But I thought about going to drama school and didn't, because I was already earning. But what I did was, as I got successful as a comic, as an entertainer, and Family Fortunes particularly gave me this opportunity, I could go off and do a rep play, because we did Family Fortunes in 3 weeks. We did the whole series, 26 shows over 3 weeks. So then I would go and do Misery at the Oldham Coliseum or Skylight at the Watermill. And I learned the craft of acting as I got older, hoping that one day, you know, I might get to the RSC. And then weirdly, 2 years ago, I got a call from my niece, Jodie McNee. And Jodie she's kind of followed in our family footsteps, really. She started as an impressionist. Mm-hmm. She had an act, and she did talent shows. In fact, I hosted a show called Give Your Mate a Break, which was a big Saturday night talent show. And when the researchers came to me, they said, we found this girl. She's fantastic in Liverpool. She's this young impressionist. She's only 13. She's brilliant. She does these amazing impressions. And I thought, oh, is this going to be our Jodie? And it was our Jodie. And I had to say to them, I had to declare an interest and say, she's my niece. And they went, oh, damn, we can't have her. She can't be on. But then she has carved out this career at the National Theatre with Cheek by Jowl and at the RSC playing leads in Shakespeare and Restoration. And she called me 2 years ago and she went, Uncle Les, because our Jodie, she still talks like that, even though, you know, she can go on stage and do brilliant RP and be amazing, do whatever accent you want. She said, Uncle Les, I'm doing this play at the RSC. It's a tragedy. restoration tragedies called Venice Preserved. And our director, Prasanna Puwanaraja, he wants to know if I know, if I can find a Liverpool actor to play me dad. And I went, oh, what? And I'm going, what? And really? And she went, do you know any?
Oh, no.
And I went, Jodie, hello. I think what she was doing, she was trying to work out, you know, would you do it?
Yeah.
And I went, I would love that. And she went, he'd love to meet you. So oh. I got to meet Prasanna the next week, and Phil Breen, who was also directing The Provoked Wife, the restoration comedy. And, you know, I was right for the part. It wasn't nepotism in the sense that Jodie got me a job. I had to audition for it and got to do it. And that was, you know, 50 years after that visit to the RSC of having watched Emrys James and thinking, I want to do that. I got to walk onto that stage in both plays, but particularly in Venice Preserved, to play this Venetian corrupt senator in this massive tragedy, you know, and to be on in the very, I was the first one to speak with this very long, complicated two-hander scene with Michael Grady Hall, who played Jafir. And it's all about the fact that he and Belvedere, my daughter, Priuli's daughter, have secretly married, and Priuli is so outraged. So I have this two-hander scene, and I could almost, because you can see people at the RSC, you can see the people sat, you know, the way in the audience, mm. It's kind of lovely light. And it's kind of people sitting there going, that's that fella at the Family Fortunes. And he's doing Shakespearean tragedy. And I think we might believe him.
Wow.
And so that was incredible. And again, coming back to the connection with my mum, you know, my mum loved Shakespeare. She loved all sorts of the arts. She had albums by Tchaikovsky as well as, you know, Grieg's Piano Concerto, Tristan and Isolde we had in the radiogram as well as the crooners. So, you know, my mum would have been so thrilled for me to have made it to the RSC. But not only did I make it to the RSC, her granddaughter, Jodie, made it to the RSC in the same production, and we were playing father and daughter in this play. So that was just incredible.
Yeah. Right at the beginning of this thing, we were chatting about the fact that when we first met,
yeah,
that strange thing where you instantly know that you like someone.
Yeah, yeah.
Within seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
And it may be because we are the same person. I went on a school trip. We went on a barge and we moored opposite the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I said to my mates, we should go and see a play. And they all said, no, we should go to the pub. And they went to the pub and I went in and I saw Ian McKellen do Romeo.
Wow.
And I walked out of that place thinking exactly the same. That's what I want to do. And for me, it was only 40 years, but 40 years later, I did exactly the same thing, turned up there finally.
Fantastic. Did you have a great time?
Absolutely brilliant time. And the same feeling that you must have had, I know exactly the feeling you would have had, the two of you on stage together. It must have been so magical.
It was incredible. And the season, you know, working with a group of great actors and me worrying, thinking, oh, gosh, I'm not trained at all. And these guys all are. But, you know, being so welcome, going to the Dirty Duck, which, you know, I'd been to, you know, because after that first visit, I went back to Stratford to watch again and again. Saw the most amazing production of The Taming of the Shrew by Michael Bogdanov with Jonathan Pryce.
And I saw that.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
It was amazing.
It was incredible.
We came on as a drunk at the beginning. And
smashed the set.
Brilliant.
Wasn't it amazing?
Amazing.
And having watched that and then getting to go to do a season and having things, I remember somebody saying, oh, next week is Shakespeare Gym. And I was like, is there a gym we can go to? And it was like, no, Shakespeare's Gym. We will have 2 hours in the rehearsal break where somebody, Greg Doran, the artistic director, or David Threlfall, will come and do a two-hour session, pick a piece from Shakespeare that you'd like to look at.
Wow.
So, I mean, the training, the extra training, you know, we weren't doing Shakespeare, but just learning from these people. David Threlfall did a masterclass for 3-4 hours, and I picked The Fool from Lear to work on, and he was just fantastic with me, and we talk now, we're good mates. We found out that we were both born on October the 12th, 1953, exactly the same day. So wow. We're kind of like birth brothers, we call each other. So the only thing to me now is that I've done the restoration there. I want to go back now and complete that jigsaw and do the Shakespeare. I haven't done Shakespeare.
Me neither. No, I did restoration. Ledge, we're going to have to do it together. We'll have to start the petition. Do you know, when I went to see Greg Doran when I was there, he said to me, if you came back, which part would you like to play? And I said, Feste.
Feste, yes.
Which was the part that Emrys James played.
Yes. Well, when I worked with Michael Bogdanov, and I remember saying to him about having seen that, and I'd seen him, you know, that thing. And I remember him saying to him, I'm probably too old for Feste, aren't I? He said, no, Feste's an old dog. Feste's an old dog.
Yeah, playing it as an old man who just has had enough of all these people. Yeah. It would be great.
Yeah, would be great.
The rain it raineth every day.
I'll fight it for you.
We'd go together.
Yeah, we'll go together. Yeah, double Feste.
Oh,
isn't that funny how we are crossing over so much?
Absolutely. It's amazing, isn't it? I did say to Greg Doran, I told him the story of coming and seeing Ian McKellen and Francesca Annis, beautiful actress Francesca Annis playing Juliet.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, that was one of the plays that made me fall in love with Shakespeare. And I said, oh, really? He said, do you remember the moment with the hand? And I said, I do.
Mm.
And we both remember this particular moment from the play where Juliet is supposed to be dead and he kills himself and he's lying on top of her, dead, Ian McKellen, and she's lying there dead. And there was this enormous pause, or it felt like it, because we knew she wasn't dead. The stillness was astonishing. And then she suddenly took this enormous breath and threw her hand in there. She went,
oh, wow.
And the whole audience went, even though we knew she was alive.
Moments of magic like that are incredible, aren't they? Mm. I remember going to see the production where Glenda Jackson and Alan Howard, Antony and Cleopatra, and I have to say that I believe it didn't get great reviews at the time. And I remember sitting there kind of getting on with it. But then on came Richard Griffiths as the slave who brings the asp. And this couple of minutes of comic business was just at such a crucial and tragic point. Some people might call it upstaging, but it was hilarious. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Richard Griffiths. So moments in plays will make you go, I remember that production vividly.
Well, God bless Emrys James, that's what I say.
Yes, yes, thank you, Emrys.
Okay, we will put Emrys James as Feste
right into
the time capsule. Okay, that's two items, Les.
Two items, yeah.
Hello, sorry to interrupt, but we're going to take a short ad break here. We'll be back with Les Dennis in something slightly longer than an instant.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There you are, more than an instant, less than a hiatus. More a pause, I'd say. So let's not waste any more time, of whatever length, and get back to the lovely Les Dennis pronto. That means instantly.
Well, I'm going to put in, and maybe we'll put all the items into this. I'm going to put in a big yellow suitcase. And when I say a yellow suitcase, it was a leather suitcase that was painted vivid yellow with a red handle. And it was Dustin G's props case.
Oh.
And again, for people who may be too young, I was in a double act with Dustin G, who was an incredible talent, massive, massive talent who we lost too early. He died in 1986, just as we were at the height of our kind of success as a double act. He'd been a solo act before, the same as I had, for years. But he was the kind of solo act that hadn't done a lot of TV, but had such a reputation in the cabaret clubs that he could top the bill. He could do a week at the Wookiee Hollow in Liverpool or, you know, Battley Variety Club. He could be a top of the bill there because he did these incredible visual impressions. He did David Bowie and put on a suit that he'd made and in a strobe light kind of levitated. He was so inventive with lighting, with props. He did the most amazing impression of Robert Mitchum, where he had a look of Robert Mitchum, and he would just put this hat on, a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, walk forwards, and the audience just applauded because it was so brilliantly visual, and then he'd stand at the mic and say, "Can't do the voice again." And Larry Grayson, he could just, you know, he would get teeth, he'd go to a dentist and have teeth made, and he'd put in a set of teeth, just kind of wet his hair down, put a pair of glasses on, and Larry Grayson was in front of you on stage.
His impersonation of Larry Grayson was extraordinary.
Yes,
I remember it vividly.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, when we had our show together, Larry came on and they did the two Larrys together, which was fantastic. I just sat and watched that. Becoming a double act with Dustin just came so accidentally. I became part of the Russ Abbott Madhouse. I'd met him very briefly when we were both on a show called Who Do You Do in the 70s, which was an impressionist show starring Freddie Starr and Little and Large and Peter Goodright and a lot of the older impressionists at that time. And I did a spot in it, and Dustin did a spot on the same day, and we just met briefly. But then when I got into Russ Abbott Madhouse, I remember saying to my then manager, Mike Hughes, who actually was Dustin's as well. I called him and I said, "But I don't know whether I can afford to stay in London. I lived in Liverpool. Where am I going to stay? I can't stay in a hotel. I can't afford it." He said, "Well, Dustin usually rents a flat. So why don't you give him a call?" So I called Dustin and he went, "Oh, hello, love. Yeah, I'm just watching a Bette Davis movie." I'll come and see you. I was in Panto with Russ in Stockport. He said, "I'll come and see you tomorrow night and we'll talk about it." Because he rented a flat in Dorset Square, mm-hmm. With another friend of ours, Russell Lane, comedy writer. And he said, "Yeah, there's two rooms and one's a twin room and one's a bunk bedroom. You could have the bunk beds and when your wife comes, you'll be fine." So he came to the stage door, knocked on my dressing room door after the panto. And this imposing guy, very well-dressed, tweed jacket, nice button-down shirt, he looked like a movie star. He looked like kind of, he had that charisma and he had a bottle of wine in his hand. He said, "I come bearing gifts." And that was such a prophetic thing for him to say, because the gifts he brought into my life were incredible. He was my best friend. We got on so well. We laughed together within the show, the Madhouse show. There was one night where basically we were there as comedy feeds for Russ in different sketches and hardly worked together. And then there was a sketch where Russ played his Sid the Spiv character and he was doing this thing called selling impressions. So he had like a kind of market stall with lots of wigs and hats and things on it. And the idea was that me and Jeff Holland and Dustin and Michael Barrymore were all hidden underneath the barrow, and Russ would get the audience to shout out, "Right, what do you give me? What do you want? What do you want? Just want Tommy Cooper?" And then somebody pop up and do a Tommy Cooper, and the audience would shout out Basil Fawlty, and Michael Barrymore would get up and do his brilliant Basil Fawlty. And there was one point where somebody said, "Vera from Coronation Street," and we all looked at each other under the thing, and Dustin just found a curly wig, jumped up, and went, "Hey, you're right, kid." And the audience went mad for it. And but he didn't have anything or know what to do from there. And I found a wig and I came up and went, "I don't really know." And I did the Mavis impression. Wow. And that came out of that sketch. And suddenly on that night, we heard the reaction that got. And John K. Cooper, the producer, the next week, there were sketches for Vera and Mavis in the pub. So we became a double act by accident.
People forget the effect of that.
Yeah.
At the time, there was not a person in the country who didn't do those impressions because of you.
Yeah.
Everybody did it.
That's right.
Everybody would say, I don't really know. We would all say it.
I know. It's incredible that out of that came this double act. And as I say, Dustin was already well known on the circuit as a solo artist and could command massive fees. And he went, no, I'd like to do this. And we did Panto together with Russ. And it was Dustin G and Les Dennis in smaller letters.
Mm-hmm.
And Dustin, I didn't know, but he went to see Mike Hughes. And then Mike called me. Mike was very autocratic, old, kind of like Samuel Goldwyn kind of entertainment entrepreneur. And, you know, you're coming to see me and I'm going to tell you what's happening. And I went to see Mike and he went, Dustin is upset. And I was like, what about? He said, he's upset that it says Dustin G and Les Dennis in smaller. So we're redoing the poster because he thinks you're both doing the same job. And I think Dustin was on, I don't know, £800 a week in Panto. Mm. And I was on £400. And he went, Dustin wants to share his wages with you.
No.
And that was incredible. It was just amazingly generous and just showed that he had a commitment to what we were doing.
Mm.
And we started that impression spot in that Panto. And Russ used to say, I have trouble following that, coming on as buttons after that, because we, as ugly sisters, we would work out, we would stand there with our wardrobe and chest of drawers and work out, instead of how we were going to look, we'd work out who we were going to go as to the ball. And we
did
this impression spot. And like Vera Mavis hardly ever met in Coronation Street. Mavis was with Rita. And Vera was Ivy Tilsley's mate. So what we ended up doing was putting the oddest combinations together. We put Billy Connolly and Bobby Ball together and Larry Grayson and Boy George. And, you know, and these odd impressions, but they kind of worked. And it was 2 years that was a whirlwind because we got our own show. We did Live from Her Majesty's the night Tommy Cooper collapsed. We were the next act on.
Oh my God. You had to follow him on.
While he was behind the curtain, they wouldn't move Tommy because the paramedics were seeing to him behind the curtain. And it was live TV and the producer, David Bell and Jimmy Tarbuck had said, are you guys ready to go on? And we were like, oh, okay. And we went on and we stormed the show. We did really well, weirdly, because the audience had felt uncomfortable, but we managed to kind of get them back.
They wouldn't have known that Tommy Cooper was dying.
No. When we were stood in the wings, I remember David Bell, when Tommy collapsed, David Bell turned and looked and said, is that a joke? And Tommy Jr., his son, said, my dad's got a bad back. He wouldn't be able to get up. He wouldn't do that. So that's when they cued commercial break and music. And then the chat went on stage and the paramedics ran on. Mm-hmm. And Tommy was behind his red curtain and we went on, and when we came off afterwards, Dustin said, that's the way I'd like to go. I'd like to go with my boots on. And 2 years later, he collapsed when we were in Panto. Dustin lived his life. He had a condition. He had a heart condition called cardiomyopathy. But nobody could tell him, you know, he was enjoying his life. He was loving it, and he lived it to the full. And nobody could tell him to calm down. And you know, I people were saying to me, you need to be his keeper. You need to look after him and make sure he's okay. There was only so much you can do. I could say, Dustin, I know you just had a fag and I know you just had a brandy or whatever, you know, but I couldn't, you know. I think 3 days before Dustin collapsed, this was the kind of guy he was. He said, I'm going to go on holiday. He said, I can't work out where I'm going to go, though, so I'm going to put lots of names into a hat and pick it out. And he put Bridlington and Barbados and, you know, and Colchester. He put a mix of, and I know that, I think he pulled out Bali and he was going to go to Bali. But if he pulled out Bridlington, he'd have gone to Bridlington. That's the kind of wonderful, funny man he was. You know, I remember him going, I need to lose weight. And he got a Slender Tone thing And he'd sit there in a restaurant with it on, and put it on high voltage. Go, ooh, that must be working. Ooh, I'll have the steak. I'll be able to have the steak. He was just kind of, he lived his own life, and he went the way he said he'd go. And the show that we were most proud of, the show where we did Bowie and Jagger with the phenomenal kind of, we did it almost exactly as they did, Dancing in the Street. We did Past It in the Street, and we did it on film properly, beautifully done. That series went out posthumously. The one had gone out before he died, and then they all went out a bit later after he died. But
good.
You know, there's a friendship and a career that we had, and a wonderful partnership that we had, that to me, it was my launch pad for everything. After I got Family Fortunes out of that, and my career as a solo artist is thank you to the legacy that Dustin gave me.
And that ridiculous great big suitcase.
Yes, the suitcase, the big prop suitcase, which had all sorts in. Yeah. Yeah.
He was a fantastically individual and funny man. He did things that you thought, how's that going to work?
Mm.
He did a brilliant Basil Fawlty, didn't he?
He did an amazing Basil Fawlty. Mm. And another thing that he had, and his sister's still got to this day, and I loved the fact that John Cleese wrote a letter to him saying, hello, Dustin, I watched your impression of Fawlty on Saturday Night TV. Loved it. Loads of people do Fawlty, but I think somehow you got the essence of the character more brilliantly than anybody else. Yours, John Cleese.
How brilliant.
And he had it framed, and, you know, so he had that there. Dustin was a brilliant clown as well as anything else.
Mm.
And a talent that, you know, was just, he was 43, so he had so much more to give. People say, oh, you probably wouldn't have been around together now. But I think what we would have done was we would have gone off like the two Ronnies did and done things separately and then come back together and always kept that because we loved working together.
That's lovely, Les. Really lovely thing to put in.
Great.
Okay, so we're on to item number four.
Yeah, item number four I'm going to show you. I know that people can't see it, but there you go. It's the Radio Times cover. This is for extras.
Oh, yeah.
And as you can see, I'm the only one that you don't know because there's Kate Winslet, there's Ricky, there's Samuel L. Jackson, Ben Stiller, Patrick Stewart, Ross Kemp, Ashley Jensen, and then there's me. And basically, when you get onto the cover of Radio Times, they invite you to the Radio Times cover party.
Oh, brilliant.
And you go along and you know, so there's been 52 covers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going along to this party at the Dorchester, I think it was. And you're amongst all these people who've been on the cover of Radio Times. And usually there's two or three people rather than as many as there were there on that extras one. And I just met my wife, Claire. We just started dating. And it was the first proper date that she came with me on. And she's not in the business, you know. And I'd forgotten, you know, of course, I'm used to going to things and meeting people and being awestruck, being starstruck by meeting so many people. But I've got used to it over the years, and Claire is on one of our first dates, coming with me to the Radio Times covers party.
Yeah, this is Ben Stiller.
Yeah.
This is Samuel L. Jackson.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Well, those people weren't there, because in that photo, I didn't even get to meet them, because that's a mock-up. We all did our photos individually. But I had my own episode in extras, which came to me at a time in my life. I thought, well, that's it. Things are over. Because, you know, I'd just come out of the Big Brother house, which wasn't probably my greatest moment. And I did consider putting that in as the thing to bury. But then I thought, if I hadn't done it, Ricky Gervais wouldn't have called.
Yeah.
You know, because he called me when the phone wasn't ringing. I got a call from my agent saying, Ricky Gervais wants you to call him. And I thought, this is a wind-up. It's John Culshaw. So I called and got Ricky's voicemail and still thought, well, it's a wind-up. It'll be John Culshaw. And then when Ricky called back, went, hello, we want you to do this part. We've got this part for you. We want you to play a twisted, demented version of yourself in this new show, Extras. So I thought, well, that's a great sales pitch, twisted, demented version. And then he said to me, he said, think Larry Sanders, think Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I was a massive fan of both those shows.
Mm.
And I realized that, you know, well, okay, then these people are going to be lampooning themselves and showing they have a sense of humor about it. And if I get it right, if, you know, I'll be able to show that I'm not Les Miserable, as the press had decided to, you know, there were lots of things, like the end of my marriage was happening just straight after Big Brother and all that stuff. So, you know, I was, you know, I had press outside my door, you know, from 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, waiting to get a shot of me looking miserable, walking with the dog or whatever. So Ricky came with this chance and I seized it. And it's gone on to prove, Ricky has said that whenever I meet him, he says, oh, it's everybody's favorite episode. Everybody loves it. And I think in a poll recently, it got top. And I'm, you know, I'm up there with these massive stars who actually are doing a cameo, whereas my episode was about me. He said, when I went in to see him and Stephen, when we were discussing it, he had the kind of the whiteboard on with all the stickers of, you know, the stars that were going to be in as cameo. And I said, and there's yours, The Man. It's called The Man. Your episode's called The Man, which it didn't end up being called that. But it's about you, and it's about I come and work with you as Andy Millman in Panto. And so it was a gift, and it came at exactly the right moment where I could be seen in a different way. And when it went out on TV, we got to go to this party, and Claire had to – I remember at one point she reminded me. She said, what about that time? We were stood there with all these people and David Attenborough and Bob Geldof, Charles Dance, Ricky Gervais, Alison Steadman. And you noticed an actor. I said, oh, just going to go over, chat to somebody. And you went off on your own. She said, what was amazing was that Bob Geldof turned to her and just had a lovely conversation with her and just chatted. But, you know, she's been the greatest support. You know, we have started again. I've got a grown-up son, Philip, who's 41. And we have two little kids, Eleanor and Tom, about to be 13 and 10. Mm-hmm. Out of that call from Ricky Gervais, my life has changed so much, and it's fantastic.
But when you say early on that you quietly on the side doing, you know, you're doing Family Fortunes, making enough money, yeah, that meant you could go off and practice the skill of acting.
Yeah,
you did study it, because that is one of the most difficult parts to play yourself, but not yourself.
Yeah.
I wish I'd been at that party.
Yes.
Sounds fantastic. We're going to put that into the time capsule.
Great.
So you can pop along for a glass of warm white wine anytime you like. Okay, final item. This is the thing you want to get rid of.
Yeah. Like I say, I thought about, should I put Celebrity Big Brother? But as I said as well, you know, if I hadn't done that, then I wouldn't be where I am. And I think that about a lot of things in life, that, you know, if you go, I don't want that, I hated that bit. But they are the things that then take you on to other things. So you shouldn't negate them and you shouldn't have regrets about them. So I've gone for something embarrassing and I've gone for it to signify those embarrassing mornings when you wake up, when you've had a drink and you wake up the next morning and go, oh, no. Oh, God.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Is that, oh, did I? Oh, no. Oh. And it was a lovely occasion and I had a great day. It was a Radio 2 Christmas party in a nice hotel in Kensington somewhere. And my friend Andy Davis, who used to co-present Jonathan Ross's radio show with him, invited me as his guest. So I went along, and the great and the good of Radio 2 are there. Lewis Carney was holding this party for a lot of the presenters. So Chris Evans, lovely Ken Bruce, Annika Rice, Janice Long, Tony Hatch. Tony Hatch, who all those years ago, he was on the panel when I was on New Faces. He was there and was just lovely. Don Black, all these great stars of Radio 2 were there. And it started, there was a tray of vodka martinis. This is 12 o'clock on a pre-Christmas day, about a week before Christmas. There's this tray of vodka martinis being handed round. It was either that or a mojito or something else. So I went for a martini. I thought, I'll be fine. But there's that saying, you know, one's not enough and three's too many.
Yeah.
Because they go down so easy. And I must have had two. And then we went downstairs to a lovely lunch, sitting there, drinking wine and chatting, getting on great with everybody. And then Tony Hatch got up and went to the piano and started singing Christmas songs. And everybody did a song. And I did, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And it went down really well. And people went, yeah. And then Chris Evans went, Les, you were in Chicago, weren't you? And I went, yeah, I was. And he went, Cellophane, do Mr. Cellophane. So Tony had said, I know it, it'll be fine, we'll do it. And the vodka martinis had kicked in by this point. And Tony had, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. And he should have gone, if someone stood up in a crowd and raised his voice up way out loud and waved his arm and shook his leg, you'd notice him. If someone in a movie show yelled, fire in the second row, this whole place is a powder keg, you'd notice him, and on with the song. He went, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. It's all right, Les, we'll start again. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. I know it now. If someone stood up could not remember a single word. So I went, let's go to the chorus. Cellophane. And I think I was talked down. I think Chris went, no, it's okay, Les, it's fine. We'll move on to somebody else.
Oh, no.
And I remember sitting back down and thinking, oh, that all these people who I admire, they were all drunk. Their faces were all blurred. I knew they were drunk. Their faces were all blurred. An old Jackie Hamilton joke. And so I remember at the end of the evening, Janice Long poured me into a taxi and I went home. And I think they went on. They went on somewhere else. But you know that thing when you wake up the next morning, you go, why didn't I just say no and not even attempt it, this big patter song? So that is, it's kind of representative of those days when the next day you've done something and, you know, you think, oh, why?
Mm-hmm. And you don't learn from it particularly, do you?
You don't learn from it, no.
No.
You don't learn from it until the next time.
I have many, many years of going to the BBC Light Entertainment Party. And that was exactly the same. I fell asleep on the last train home and woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning on the sidings in Hastings. So, not a good night.
Those light entertainment parties at the BBC, the Christmas parties, they were great, weren't they?
Great.
I remember being there and, you know, in the 80s, and all our lot, the variety lot, me and Dustin and Little and Large, we're all over one side of the room, and there's Rick Mayall and Ben Elton and French and Saunders and all the kind of alternative lot all over one other side of the room, because at that time the media had this idea that we all hated each other, which wasn't true. And then I remember the Kofi Annan of comedy, Barry Cryer, managed to get us all to mingle and mix. And by the end of the night, we'd had a lovely time and we'd all connected and realized we're all in the same business.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny?
Funny.
It illustrates how awful it was for Claire to stand there going, I don't know anybody, because we are like that with other people
in
our business, aren't we? We can be, they won't know who I am.
Oh, Les, well, there we are. Too many of those parties. I've been to a number of them, you know, and watched other people make fools of themselves and think, thank God I don't drink.
Yeah, exactly.
If only. Oh,
yeah.
Les, how lovely to see you and how lovely to talk.
And you. I loved that. It was really great.
Great.
Thank you, Michael.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Les Dennis. If you enjoyed this episode half as much as I enjoyed recording it, then please subscribe to My Time Capsule on Acast or your usual podcast provider. Well, we hope that if you get the chance, you will rate the show and maybe leave a short review. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by searching me or at @mytcpod. And the theme music you can hear in the background is available in the foreground on Spotify. It was written and performed by Pass the Peas Music. This podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens and was a cast-off production. Oh, and my latest album, Nat King Cole's Impressive Number Tunes, is available from all bad record stores now. See ya.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.